This is a thrilling moment. I remember discovering Ray Liotta in the 80s in a cinema in Frankfurt. Well, I remember especially sitting next to somebody who was just painfully stinking. So I had the privilege to see the film. It was Something Wild in an Odorama version. And in those days, I must confess also, I had a crush more on Melanie Griffith. But despite Melanie Griffith and despite the Adorama factor, I couldn't miss the outstanding performance by a young newcomer named Ray Liotta. And some years later, I rediscovered Ray Liotta as a larger-than-life character in Goodfellas, evidently, and with this film, he definitely entered my personal pantheon. Yesterday, Ray Liotta has been awarded with the first Luxembourg City Film Festival Life Achievement Award. It's a long word. And tonight, Ray Liotta is here in person for his masterclass, and I feel very honored by that. And I want to thank Ray Liotta so much for having accepted the invitation. And I want to thank Boyd van Hooy, the renowned film critic for The Hollywood Reporter, for moderating the masterclass. So before welcoming Ray Liotta, let's have a look at a tribute clip.
Charlie, wow. You are one dumb son of a bitch.
I want Lulu.
As far back as I can remember, I always wanted to be a gangster.
What am I, a schmuck on wheels?
Maury, please. You know, Jimmy, you borrowed his money. Pay him.
Didn't agree to 3 points above the VIG. What am I, fucking nuts?
What are you gonna do?
Come on.
You're gonna fight with Jimmy Conway? He wants his money. Give him his money and let us just get the fuck out of here.
Hey, pay me my money.
Okay, 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 okay.
What the fuck are you doing with the dead cop's gun? Huh? Answer me. What are you doing with the dead cop's gun? Answer me.
Fuck that, man. I don't know nothing about no fucking dead cop's gun.
This is a police issue revolver. It belongs to a slain officer. What are you doing with
that
it?
That was not in there.
What?
That fucking gun wasn't in there.
Shut up. What are you doing with it, huh?
Shut me out, Ray. You found us a sweet little town, you got us the low interest, and I'm grateful. But don't forget who it was that you came to 2 years ago to cover your ass.
Get him out of here, Freddy.
It's not my fault that you can't look at him. Don't shut me out, Ray.
You come to my house with a loaded gun? You speak to me like I'm a fucking idiot. What's your game? Fear me.
Why can't you just admit it? Say it. I killed him.
Please stop it. He can't take anymore.
Because everything is okay now. Everything is fine. We got the guy. It's fine.
I don't know what we got.
What?
We thought we got the guy 2 hours ago. Then we find him.
You believe this shit? It's him! It's this guy! He had a knife to your neck! Remember?
Father, we thank thee for thy blessings and to dedicate them to thy mercy. Forgive us all, even white trash like Starling here, and bring her into my service. Amen.
By the way, Starling, that was a job offering I worked into the blessing.
Give me the keys, I'm driving.
Sure,
give me
that's a good idea.
You don't tell me what to do, I tell you what to do. I'm the boss, you're the employee. As a matter of fact, from now on, you call me boss. Now give me the keys. You're a stupid little girl who doesn't know a thing. I'm fucking in there having chemo for 5 fucking hours.
So, ladies and gentlemen, please welcome warmly Mr. Ray Liotta.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Welcome to the Cinematheque and welcome to the Luxembourg City Film Festival. I want to get started straight away with a very easy question. When did you first become aware that acting was a thing?
Like a thing to do?
Yeah.
Well, when I went to summer camp when I was young, you know, you ride horses, you swim, you do. I played Fagin and Oliver. You know, the whole thing was like 20 minutes long. Then in my senior year in high school, we had an elective, and me and my best friend, who still is my best friend since third grade, we took a drama class, but that was just to play and, you know, take it easy and not really take it serious. I was very big in sports, and I had a fight with my basketball coach, and the drama teacher asked me to be in the play, and I did it, and I hated it. I hated everything about it. So I never really thought of it as something to do. But when it came time to go to college, and my dad said, go wherever you want, take whatever you want. And I had no idea what I wanted to do. So I got into the University of Miami, which at that time, you just needed a pulse to get in there. So I was in line for registration, and I was just going to take liberal arts. And when I got into the front of the line, they said, well, you have to take a math and a history. I said, well, I don't want to take math and history. I don't even want to be in college. Right next to it was for the drama department. So I took a step over and said, I'll be a drama major for a year and just play and have fun like I did with my friend Gene. And so that was my first introduction, but still not wanting to do it. And a pretty girl in line asked me if I was going out for the play that night, and I said no, and then she berated me. You got to do the play. It's all about doing the plays. So I auditioned, and I got in, and the first thing I did was I was a dancing waiter in cabaret. And the whole first year, all I did was musicals. But there was an acting teacher there by the name of Buckets, meaning that he used to play basketball. You put it in the bucket. And that's when it seemed intriguing, but it still took a while until, and then I did the whole 4 years, and it was towards my junior, senior year that I decided that I would give this a try.
So was there one particular moment when you thought, this, I'm going to be serious about it, or how did that evolve?
No, I just was having fun, and for some reason, I was like any kid in high school, very self-conscious, wasn't really free and open in front of people, but for some reason when I was down there, since I didn't know anybody, and I really liked what this teacher was saying. He wore these dark glasses, and he would be directing with, you know, all intense, and I just liked what he had to say. And like anything, that he started saying nice things, and you start doing plays and people start saying nice things. So I said, well, Maybe I'll give this a shot. But there wasn't any one particular moment that it all clicked for me.
So you were in Miami, and then you ended up in LA, if I've got this right. How was that sort of, I mean, there must have been a decision where you said, okay, I want to go and pursue this seriously.
No, first, when I graduated college, I went the 4 years, got a Bachelor of Fine Arts degree, went straight up to New York, because by my senior year, I said, all right, I'm going to do this. I'm serious about it. I'd never even went to see movies. The only movies that I would go to see were the Beatles movies and Clint Eastwood movies. And so I started really getting in and watching movies, and it was a great period of time during the 70s when Coppola and Scorsese and Gene Hackman, Duvall, De Niro, Pacino, all these, they were making great movies. I said, now that's what I want to do. That's the kind of movie I want to make. So I moved to New York, and I got a job as a bartender for the Schubert Organization, where I collected coats and sold drinks to people who were coming in to watch Broadway shows. And then during the day, I would audition. But the third day I was in New York, I got a commercial Within a week, I had a manager, and then the next week, I had an agent. And then I got, I auditioned for a soap opera, and I got the job, and I didn't want to do it because I wanted to do Pacino movies. I wanted to do Scorsese movies. And my dad, who was a depression baby, said, look, first of all, it's money. Two, all you've been doing are plays. You've never worked in front of a camera. And he made a lot of sense. So I did the soap, and I took it very serious. I rehearsed and learned my lines and stayed doing it for 3 years. But when I turned 25, I said, all right, that's it. I'm gonna move to L.A. and try my hand at movies. And nothing happened. For 5 years, I did a couple of guest shots, and then I finally got my first movie, Something Wild. I went to acting class. I took acting class right from the beginning. So for 5 years, twice a week, I was studying, and then I got Something Wild.
The Jonathan Demme movie. We have a short clip of that. Let's take a look at that.
Supposed to act it out?
Am I Melody Griffith in this case?
Yeah, let me have the Rustler's Rhapsody.
Rustler's
Just
Rhapsody.
Coffee for me, Darlene.
In a flash.
You don't mind, do you, Ray?
Charlie, you gotta be out of your mind. You don't know what you're doing.
Charlie, you are one dumb son of a bitch. I'm almost starting to like you, Charlie.
Here you go.
Thanks, darling. I want Lulu. Is that your name this week? Lulu?
Yes.
You know, Charlie, she's not going to be too happy driving around in a station wagon the rest of her life. You better think about that. You better ask yourself if you really want her.
I really want her.
Aww.
Great.
Charlie, you gotta fight for a woman like this.
I don't have to fight you, Ray. I'm gonna take Lulu. We're gonna waltz right out of here, and there's not a damn thing you can do.
Oh, Charlie, you are something. You are something.
I hope you don't mind seeing yourself in clips because
I don't really watch myself.
The character that you play in the film is also called Ray. Was that one of the reasons why you were like, this part, I've got to get this part?
No. What happened was I was 30 years old. I hadn't done a movie. I was on a series called Our Family Honor, and with Eli Wallach and Ken McMillan, and it got canceled. My friends in the acting class were telling me about Something Wild, and I went home for Christmas that year. I was living in L.A. I went home, and I was telling my parents, they're asking me how it was going out there, and I was very depressed because here I was 30 and still hadn't done a movie, and most people usually get started in their 20s. So they said, why don't you call Melanie up, because I knew Melanie because I went to college with her then husband, Stephen Bauer. And I said, no, I'm not going to do it that way. And then I just slept on it and thought about it, or actually didn't sleep. And I said, you know what, I'm going to call Melanie up. And it just so happened that Melanie, Jonathan Demme, the director, gave Melanie say in who would play her husband, because she had a very bad experience with an actor that played her husband before. So she called up Jonathan and said, Jonathan, I want you to meet this guy, Ray Liotta. And Jonathan said, no, Melanie, I have it down to three people. This has been a very long, tough process to find the right guy. And she really put her foot down and said, Jonathan, you said that I would have a say. You said I could help with my husband, and I want you to see Ray. So I went and met Jonathan. Then that was it. So I said, all right, I met the director. A casting director isn't like holding me back. I got a call on Tuesday to come and read with an actress they had hired to do a couple scenes. I said, great, if I don't get the job now, at least it's because I'm not right for it, but at least I'm getting to show my stuff. So I did it, and I felt really good with it. Then on Thursday, I get a call, and they said, come, and we want you to read with Jeff Daniels. So I said, oh, geez, all right, that's great. And at that time, I was watching Johnny Carson was on, and who's the first guest but Jeff Daniels? And he's talking about working with Woody. He had just done Purple Cairo, about Rose, Purple Rose of Cairo. And then he was talking about Jack because he just did Terms of Endearment with him. And so I'm doing push-ups. I'm getting ready. And I went and auditioned. And I was just so prepared from all the years of studying. And I said, I'm going to read with the guy. And one of the scenes, was when I get really, really intense and go nuts on Jeff. And I went nuts on Jeff. And I got a call that Saturday that Jonathan wanted to meet me before he went home to New York. And so we had breakfast in West Hollywood before his flight, and he says, look, I'm going to go home. I'm going to think about this. As you know, I had narrowed it down to three guys, and I'm going to let you know by the middle of the week, one way or the other. So to me, the middle of the week was Monday, but Monday, nothing. Tuesday, nothing. Wednesday, nothing. I said, oh, man, it didn't work out. But at least I felt a little better because he saw me get to act with the guy, so I guess I just wasn't right. And then I got a call from his assistant saying that Jonathan was going to call me at 3 o'clock. Would I be home? I said, yeah, of course I'll be home. I've been living next to the phone for three days now. And I got a call, and I used to use the name. He says, Ray, I would like you to play Ray in something wild. And I remember I hung up the phone, and there was so much emotion in me. I just broke down and cried that I'd finally gotten a movie. So that's the Ray story.
So obviously that was a big breakthrough, finally. Getting a big part in a feature film. Can you remember something about the experience of actually shooting it? Was it anything like you imagined? And was that soap preparation you did before any help?
Well, the one thing he said he wanted me to lose some weight. He wanted me to be really lean. So I was living in Hollywood, and I used to play basketball in this park. And in the park, there were just a lot of tough types who were playing basketball, and it was gated. There was a gate, so I just pretended that I was in prison, and that the guys that were playing basketball were like guys who were in prison who were playing basketball, and they were doing, you know, some people were just walking and talking, and I would just run, you know, to lose the weight that he wanted. But at the same time, I was doing homework like I was in prison, because my character, you know, was in prison for 10 years. I get out, and then I see her. So I just studied and studied and studied. And the acting teacher that I had at that time and stayed with through for the first 7 years of
until Goodfellas, right?
Mm-hmm.
Until Goodfellas, you did Goodfellas.
Even after Goodfellas, yeah. So I would do something wild. I go back to class with Harry. I would do Field of Dreams, back to class with Harry. Goodfellas, back to class with Harry. The next movie, back to house. I just believed that he had me believing that basically playing pretend is just using your imagination. And his thing was, your imagination is like a muscle. The more you exercise it, the stronger it gets. So that's why I would constantly go back to class, and it was like going to the gym. It was working out for me.
Yeah, we already mentioned Goodfellas. Of course, we're going to have to talk about this film. we've got a short clip of that one as well.
This one I'll watch.
did? Who did what?
This guy who lives across the street from me that I've known all my life.
What?
Look, he started to touch me. He started to grab me. I told him to stop. He didn't stop. I hit him back. And then he got really angry. He pushed me out of the car.
You sure you're all right? Huh? Why don't you go inside and get yourself together? We'll clean up.
What do you want, fucko? You want some?
Huh? Oh, hey! What are you doing?
I swear my fucking mother, if you touch her again, you're dead!
Don't shoot! Hydras, are you all right? Are you all right?
Yeah.
Huh?
Yeah. I know there are women like my best friends who would have gotten out of there the minute their boyfriend gave them a gun to hide. But I didn't. I gotta admit the truth. It turned me on.
So, yeah, Goodfellas. Obviously, a classic, but not just the movie itself, but especially your character. Henry Hill. What do you think made his character so memorable?
No, it was just the right part at the right time, at the right time in my life. The writing, it really, I mean, I'm obviously joking. The writing was just unbelievable. It was from the book called Wise Guys. That was the original title. And I mean, it's Martin Scorsese directing it. And I remember asking him, I said, Marty, how do you do this? How do you direct? And he said, for this particular movie, he was going to direct it like he was a gangster. And he said, I'm going to freeze frame. If I want to freeze frame, I'm going to do voiceover. I'm going to, whatever it is, whatever they say that you're not supposed to do in film school, I don't care. I'm going to do. And he just, that gave him a lot of freedom to do whatever it was that he wanted to do. And he did. So it's real. I mean, it's really all about Marty and the music, and everybody was just, it just clicked. It was one of some movies you never know what's going to happen. On paper, it seems like it could work out, and it doesn't. This one, when Goodfellas first opened, it wasn't like some huge big box office movie. It just slowly grew over the years, and now 25 years later, I have little kids, 10, 12 year old kids coming up to me saying they had just seen Goodfellas, and I said, what kind of parents do you have? You're 12 years old. But they it just keeps going.
You already mentioned Scorsese, of course. He seemed to be going against the grain of directing this particular film you suggested. What kind of a director was he? Is there room for improvisation when he's on set, or does he stick closely to the script? How does he direct the actors?
You could improv a little, like the scene between Joe and I, You're a Funny Guy. That was, we had 2 weeks of rehearsal, which is really unusual. And Joe was telling this story about what had happened to him at an Italian restaurant in the Bronx, where some guy was telling a story and Joe found it funny. And he said, well, that's a funny story. You're a funny guy. And the guy just turned on him. And this was like a real mobster type person, and Joe was telling that story, and Marty, being just as smart and as open as he is, said, well, I could put that at the head of, because really what that scene would have started with the guy coming over with the bill, and Joe says, just put it on my tab. And then the guy says, come on, Tommy, I mean, your tab is getting really big. And then Joe takes the bottle and hits the guy on the head. So that's how that scene would have started. That's how it was in the script. Joe and I improvised that the scene, "You're a funny guy." And then once we improvised it, Marty and his assistant wrote the dialogue down, and it then became a specific scene. And when we did it, the first take, Joe still was kind of like in improv mode and started improvising, and Marty, no, I want the improv. This improv is now a scene. So we did it as the scene because Marty, the way he moves the camera, it moves on certain words. So if you're not doing what he sees visually, it doesn't work for him. So we did it just as we had rehearsed it, we improvised, and then it became the scene. And then towards the end of it, I added, he said something, "You're going to crack under pressure." And then I think I said, "Oh, you really are a funny guy." And then he takes the gun out. And the very end of it was improv. But pretty much all of this was exactly how it was in the script. He just gives you room, and then he just leaves you alone. I think like most directors, they feel 90% of the movie, they know what they're going to do technically, but the movie is all in the casting. And you cast the right people, then the people that he thinks are right for the role, it kind of like takes a lot of the work out of it, because you feel, you know, that's just the way Marty and a lot of directors direct.
Obviously, when people think about Goodfellas, the first thing that comes to mind is gangsters in a very male world. But we already saw your scene with Karen here. And we have another clip of a very important scene with her. And I want to talk a little bit about your character relationship with her after that.
Karen. What are you doing? Karen, are you crazy?
Yeah. Crazy enough to kill the both of you.
Karen, take it easy. Okay?
Do you love her? Do you?
Karen. I love you. You know I love you.
No.
Karen.
No, you don't.
Karen. Please be careful. Baby, don't.
But still, I couldn't hurt him. How could I hurt him? I couldn't even bring myself to leave him. The truth was that no matter how bad I felt, I was still very attracted to him. Why should I give him to someone else? Why should she win?
Karen.
Are you fucking crazy, Karen? Are you crazy? Huh? I got enough to worry about getting fucking whacked down the street. I gotta fucking come home. I gotta fucking come home for this. I should fucking kill you.
How does it feel?
Huh? Huh? How does it feel, Karen?
You said that was improv, that the bit at the end, or?
Yeah, I think that the hitting of the door, I gotta come home for this, I think was, I'm supposed to go and get my coat, and I just whacked the door there and broke stuff, yeah.
I chose the two clips because I want to talk a little bit about, as I said earlier, people's minds, it's a very male film, but your character really exists because of his relationship with Karen, I think, and it's what humanizes the character in a way. Can you talk a little bit about how you prepared or how you fleshed out the psychology of the character, and not so much the violence, but in the sort of human relationships?
Well, again, that was what was written, but I went and sat and talked with Nick Pileggi, who wrote the book. And he gave me tons and tons of cassettes that he had when he was interviewing Henry Hill. So back then, you put a cassette in the car. Wasn't an 8-track, but it was a cassette. And the movie was pushed for a bit. And I was home, and I would listen to the cassettes. I would drive, and I would just listen to Henry talking to Nick Pileggi. And a lot of it that wasn't in the book, you really got a sense of who Henry was. The only thing that drove me crazy is I don't like loud crackling of food. And through it on the cassette, he was eating potato chips and just crunching and just talking. And he couldn't care what was being heard. He would crunch those potato chips. And I said, oh, God, this guy's going to drive me crazy. So for hours and hours and hours, I would listen to the cassette. And he would talk about how he loved his kids. He just was really, you know, like it says in the movie, he grew up across the street from these guys, and he really felt like that's the kind of life he wanted to be a part of. And women was a big part of it. They all had these beautiful women. They all were dressed really nice. So, yeah, it's really the story of this young couple who get brought into this crazy world.
Of course, there is violence in both clips that we saw, and also in a lot of the other roles that you've done. Do you feel that as an actor, when you have to perform those kinds of scenes, it requires a different kind of acting muscle, or do you not separate like the dialogue, pure dialogue scenes, from action and violence?
No, the action and violence is part of who, in this particular part, who the person is. Henry really was not a violent person. He couldn't have gotten as far as he did and so deep into knowing so much about the mafia if he wasn't quiet and did what they said. He was really their gopher. Whatever they wanted done, Henry would do. And if he was violent, that means he would have, you know, that was for Joe's character and De Niro's character. They were the wound up crazy ones. And then when you are doing a violent or you're playing somebody who is physical, you know, I play a lot of cops. They do physical things. That's just what happens. But you don't separate it. You just make it part of who, like me, Ray, I've never been in a fight in my life, ever. So for me, it's fun doing this because I don't. That's not who I am. That's not how I behave.
When a film turns out to be great, or even becomes a classic, and like in the case of Goodfellas, of course that must make you feel good when you're part of that. But at the same time, as an actor, you're only a small part of it, in a sense that, I mean, it's a group effort directed by someone else. Can you talk a little bit about how you see the place of the actor in the whole sort of scheme of things of a whole movie?
Yeah, the actor's job is to fulfill the story that's written. It's same for the director, for that matter. The director's job is to fulfill what the writer is king. It's all in the writing. Other than the director takes that story and gives it a visual look, but from the script. It all starts with the script, and then what you do as an actor, you're just one of when a movie works like this, it's the DP this was Ballhouse, Michael Ballhouse, who was the DP on this. It was him doing his job. It was Mr. Bruno who did all the clothes. It takes a village. It really does to make a successful movie. Marty does his own editing with Thelma Schumacher, yeah. and there's the music. It's a combination of everything, and sometimes it all falls in place, and other times it doesn't. Sometimes you don't have enough money to do it the way that you want it. I heard Marty and Bob and Pesci and I think Harvey Keitel are doing a movie called The Irishman, but no studios wanted to make a $100 million gangster movie, so Netflix came in and they're doing a movie with Netflix. $100 million. I don't know. That's a lot of dead bodies.
As you said, you're a part of a much bigger team. Have there been movies that you really particularly enjoyed making that maybe didn't find the audience that you expected?
Oh my gosh. Yeah,
because definitely. I imagine even just the atmosphere on the set, sometimes, it must be the greatest, and then you see the final result, and for some reason it doesn't come together.
Yeah, it just doesn't click. Yeah, I did a movie called The Identical, and it was, I think, some of the best stuff that I've ever done. I played a preacher, and I wanted my son to follow in my footsteps, because as far as my character was concerned, there's no greater calling than to serve God. And what he wants to do is music. He wants to be a singer. And I'm saying, no, you have to be. It was a really, really beautiful, beautiful story. Seven people saw it. They got so cocky. They got so, it was the people that made it, one in particular, really was an extremely religious person. And when I asked him how many people, like, how are you going to release this? What's going to happen? And he says, do you have the means to release it the way it's supposed to be released? He says, Ray, we've got one thing that the other movies don't have. Well, not with this movie. Then you really have to have people, because there's so much that goes into getting a movie released. Sometimes a movie deserves it, and then how many times have we seen a movie that makes hundreds of millions of dollars, and all you're thinking about is what Chinese restaurant you want to go to when it's over? It's just so unfulfilling. Because they just throw money at it. So, what was your question again?
My question was about what there.
Oh, how many movies that I've done that didn't get it? Yes. There've been quite a few, and they're independent movies. And unless you win a film, unless you get into a film festival, or and then they get this distribution. Like this year on the Academy Awards, a lot of the movies were independent movies that were bought at film festivals.
Yeah.
That's why I think it's great that you have one here. And I hope this, the Luxembourg, it's such a, everybody is so great. The city is beautiful. The country is beautiful. It's this big. it really could, but what's going to happen is what happened in Sundance. Right now, it's independent movies. And it's director driven, and what's going to happen is you're going to start needing sponsors, and it's going to have to start getting bigger. Either somebody, like, you're going to have Kodak or Coca-Cola or somebody start sponsoring it. That's going to make it more commercial. And what's going to make it, the reason they're going to put money in is because they're going to think they could make money, and it's a vicious cycle to do something that's really. I don't know who started. I think it was the woman last night who broke her foot. Yeah, thank God for people like that who want to do things, and hopefully, but the independent movies are few and far between now. They're for a while there were great guns, and maybe because of the success and then what won best movie, even what won then didn't win best movie, where there were two independent movies.
They were both
movies.
Independent.
La La Land was an independent movie, and Moonlight was an independent movie. So maybe people realize that not everything has to be $100 million in order to make some money, but they just get so greedy.
Now that you're mentioning money, I want to talk a little bit about...
No, you can't borrow it.
I'm just a poor film critic. About the producer credits on your resume, because you've also produced some films, including Narc, which is one of your best parts, I think. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about why you thought it was important to cross over to the other side and become a producer as well.
Because I wanted a say in how it was. I would like to do it more. I have 5 movies right now that I think the scripts, if I get the right people and the right budget, I know people will respond to it, because they're, again, it's the writing. They're just beautiful, beautiful stories. But it's nice to have some control instead of just being do this and do that. You get to control things through your performance, but you know, you don't have a say in the editing. You don't have a say in the music that they're using. You don't have a say in how many theaters it's going to open in. And as a producer, you're involved in, and they listen to what you have to say. I've been doing this a long time now, so I see things that maybe someone who's just starting out doesn't see. So it's nice to have some control over what you're doing and who's in it.
Obviously, after Something Wild and then Goodfellas, you became a known face. You became someone famous, which in a way is sort of a strange oxymoron, in the sense that a known actor, I mean, theoretically, the actor disappears into the role. So what I'm curious about is, how do you deal with people's expectation of what Ray Liotta is?
Mom, I'm not sure what you mean by the question.
You've become famous after these roles, and then people have a certain expectation of what kind of roles you're going to do and how you're going to be, just purely based on what they've seen.
Right.
How do you deal with that?
Well, that I can't control. What somebody thinks of me, I'm just me. It's a great way to make a living. It's a tough business, but you see some of these actors or even singers, for that right, that think there's something special because they play pretend for a living. And they're arrogant, and they're self-entitled, and they're self-important, and they're self-righteous, and you're playing a children's game for a living, for God's sakes. Like, who do you think you are? like, so for me, I'm just me, Ray. Now, there's sometimes, like there were people outside that were waiting, and they wanted to for me to sign something, but I'm being rushed along, so this happens on time, so I didn't get to do it. So if there's, you know, and sometimes you could hear them cursing, you know, and you don't like to disappoint people. You want to be nice, and I get it. I've had an up and down career, like most actors, but I've really been up and down, and it's much nicer when it's up, and when it's up, it means people are watching your movies. So they're the expectations of people, you know, chasing after you or wanting an autograph or a picture. You have to do it. You can't be snobby. Sometimes you just can't. Sometimes for whatever reason,
logistical reasons. Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Logistical reasons.
Yeah. Well, for whatever. But at the end of the day, it's the people who get. They watch. You are where you are because people watch. So you.
They buy the tickets.
You do what you have to do. Yeah.
We've got another clip of a movie from a bit more recent one from 2009.
Is this a surprise?
It's observing.
Oh, jeez.
Harrison, I thought we were brothers of the badge. How the fuck do you sleep at night?
Come on, let's do this the easy way, all right? You just come outside and we'll talk all about it, all right?
Can't do that.
Let's go. We'll talk about it outside, but you gotta get out of here.
You can go outside. This is my world.
We don't want to hurt you, Ronnie. You want to get hurt?
You didn't bring enough pigs to hurt me.
sure about that?
Why don't we find out, huh?
All right, go get him.
I got a question.
Yes.
What was the point of showing that?
Well, what is a movie?
I can't wait to hear this question.
It's because I think it is a very interesting film tonally.
Oh, totally.
Yeah, and that's why I want to talk about it.
Totally. This is a sick movie.
Yeah.
It really was. It's a comedy, and obviously with Seth, but it crossed over lines that made people uncomfortable.
No, that's why I want to talk about it, because of course, I mean, there are certain genres that people expect you to expect you to see you in this, but this is a comedy, a sort of dark comedy, action comedy, which is a really, really hard thing to do right, and here they did it perfectly, I think. So I sort of wonder, when you're reading scripts, are you thinking about the genre as well, or are you trying to say, okay, I don't only want to do this, I'm interested in different films, because you've done a lot of different genres, but people tend to associate you with...
I took it on because I knew it was a comedy, but the best comedies are when you commit to what it is, the absurdity or whatever it is that you're doing. I mean, Seth Rogen beating up all those people, that's just not going to happen. So you have to commit to what it is that you're doing. So, yes, you do take the genre. I mean, I do hope you have some of my Muppet movie clips, because I've done a few movies with the Muppets, and the last one I did, The Muppets Most Wanted, was myself and Danny Trejo singing and dancing with Tina Fey in a Russian gulag with Kermit and a bunch of the other Muppets. Now, that I'm proud of. So, of course, you're doing that, and you know you're making a Muppet movie, so it's the situation is obscure, but it's just so much fun because you're there and Danny Trejo took it so serious. He would talk to the Muppets in between
takes,
in between takes, and ask them like what did they do like the night before, and then we became friends with them and. Don't tell anybody, but they would all of a sudden pretend like the Muppets, like we're just at an orgy or like we're drunk and oh, did we have a night last night? Miss Piggy went, and the things that they were saying was just so much fun. But you know, as you're doing it, as you're working, you know, there's a guy, and it's. I mean, most of the pictures that I have, whenever I see kids, I show them the pictures of me and me kissing Miss Piggy. I do two Muppet movies. I'm very proud of that.
No, and I think also as an actor, it must be. It must be a joy to be able to flex different muscles and tell different stories, and also find different audiences with different.
No question. I love playing pretend, and that's basically all we're doing. It's a children's game with children's rules. You're just doing it on an adult level, and if you think more of that, then it's crazy. There's some movies like in the beginning. When you start, where you're a little more method, where you hold on to the character almost 24/7, and there's voices or accents that you hold on to that you have to work really hard at. But at the end of the day, you're playing pretend.
Do you feel like over the years you've changed as an actor? Do you have a sense that you're doing things differently now than you were doing them in the 80s?
I think yes. I think I trust my instincts and trust myself more to know that it's going to be there. Like if I have to do a scene and I'm gonna tear up, when I used to have to do that, I would, one, be dreading it, saying, oh my gosh, I gotta cry like in a month. and then you work on you're thinking of it, and are the tears gonna be there, and you overthink it. And now, just at the drop of a hat, I don't mean this to sound pretentious but I've worked on my instrument so much, and I'm constantly always thinking about acting and watching people, and I take what I do really serious, and I truly, truly mean this. I truly feel like I haven't made it, and I truly feel like I have. That for me, it was getting started late, like my first movie at 30. I truly believe the best is yet to come.
You've played a lot of bad guys, of course, and also a lot of cops, like we saw here, who are supposedly the good guys, in any case. and now also you're in Shades of Blue, playing another cop. Do you get the impression, having played so many of them, that they're really different sides of the same coin, cops and robbers?
Oh, yeah. I mean, like they say, you know, in order to catch a bad guy, you have to think like the bad guy. I definitely think you have to understand what motivates and what makes people tick. And I, in the beginning, I used to do so much research, and I've done things where I've rode around with cops in South Central LA, but I also played a heart surgeon where I would go and watch open heart surgeries, and I wouldn't go for the saw and the opening of the chest. But I would sit back and watch, and I would go. I was just fascinated by these people who are literally like performing open heart surgery, where I went so much that one day the doctor turned to me and said, "Would you like to come up and watch me do this? You want to stand next to me?" I said, "Yeah, my gosh, I would love to." So there I was. I walked up and there's this woman, and she's wide open, and he looks at me, and he says, "Do you want to touch her heart?" I said, oh my God, that's touching God. So I said, yeah. and I went down, and I touched this woman's heart. It was just unbelievable. Then the nurses, at the end in the beginning of it, they recognized me. So they said, "Are you going to come back tomorrow?" I said, "If you'll have me." And so I did. And they set up and prep everything before the doctors come in to do the surgery. And they said, "All right, well, can we take the pictures?" And I'm saying, "Oh, man, now I got to go out. I got to scrub up again." But, of course, they're letting me do it. Then they said, "No, we'll do it right here." They took the pictures over the body. They would come. They came next to me. We pull down our things, we smile, there's a patient there who's, and then they went back to work. It's a very odd job I have.
Special kind of selfie, yeah. I'm wondering, when you get a screenplay, obviously you're looking at the part that you're considering, but you're also looking at the story in general, what kind of genre it is, what kind of themes maybe might be in the screenplay. Are all these things also still present when you start acting, or do you really have to shut everything else out and think about only what the character knows?
Yeah, you can't have any judgments whatsoever. You're using the personal. All people want to see is the human you, not the personal you. What Ray thinks about something doesn't matter. I would never do 90% of the stuff that they have me doing, but to play pretend and do it, I allow my humanness to come forward and then take on the character and do what you have to do. But I don't. There was one movie I did where I was a cop, and there was some racist stuff in it, and I felt horrible. I truly, for like a week after I did what I had to do on screen, it was just horrible. So I can't believe I said those words. It really, really bothered me. So that happens, but it was such a great part, and the movie did well. But yeah, there's some things, if you think about, you could talk yourself right out of it.
We've got one last clip, a big scene from a very small movie.
I don't want to keep you waiting too long. I got a little lost on the way.
No problem. So, I'm sorry I couldn't get it all. We haven't saved much since we bought our house. But I was able to get $75,000 out of our home equity line. Why in the world did you just do that?
You ever hear the old saying, you pays your money and you takes your choice?
No.
Well, now you have.
Well, by the way, Beck and I are done. So feel free to go take advantage and poke around that cum hole all you want, because I don't care anymore! You know, I gave you a choice. I gave you a choice, Jeffrey. You could have told your wife the truth instead of meeting me here. You could have been a good guy. But no, you're a rat. Just like my wife. You're a little punk rat. A boy man rat. Look at you. Just look at you. And you deserve a lot worse than losing some petty cash to the Skagit River. You know, when I discovered what you did, I was gonna kill you. But then I remembered, I'm not that kind of man. I'm the kind of man who makes a mistake and then makes amends. I'm the kind of man who got into a drunk driving accident and nearly killed a kid. But then I get some fancy pants lawyer to get me off scot-free because I was just below the legal limit? Uh-uh. I prayed for forgiveness and I pled guilty. And when the judge ordered me to pay $1 million to the kid's family, and he sent me to jail for a month, did I stop there? No. I started helping people, volunteering, philanthropy. Because that's the kind of guy I am. You may wish you're that kind of man, but you're not. You're a scumbag homewrecker. You wrecked my home, Jeffrey. You wrecked my home. And I could just as easily wreck yours with one phone call. But I don't need to do that. Because you're the kind of guy who's gonna fuck it all up himself.
I forgot about that one.
That's why you were looking at it.
Yeah, I
love this scene because it doesn't rely on violence, and it doesn't rely on, I mean, it feels very big, but the only reason it feels so big is because the acting is big. It's a big moment. So I wanted to talk a little bit about the difference between the big scenes. I mean, of course, when you're reading a screenplay, there are some scenes where you know you have a lot of dialogue, you know there's a lot of things to do. And also, then there are smaller scenes. I mean, do you distinguish between the two? Is one more fun than the other? Is one harder than the other?
First of all, what you try to do, the way I've been studying, is you don't want to ever think like an actor. So they're not lines that you're learning. Really, what lines are thoughts. You know, when you write something down, it's a thought. It's not a line. So you take these thoughts, and these thoughts show you what you're thinking. And it doesn't matter if it's big or if it's small, he cheated with my wife, so and ruined my life. So what's the worst way to hurt him for the type of person he is like what I said was is to take his money and throw it away because that's what he cared so much about, and to throw that away. So you don't look at you're just dealing with what. Like I approached Miss Piggy and Kermit the exact same way that I did this. You align yourself to what they're telling you you're thinking, and then you express what the thoughts are.
This was a smaller film that you've done. You've done quite a few independent films already, you said yourself. Do you feel there are important differences for an actor, purely for an actor, between doing smaller films and doing bigger films?
Doing a smaller film really makes you rely on doing your homework. And because you only have maybe from anywhere from 22 to 25 days to make a movie, you're doing it at a fast pace. So you really have to have your homework down and know what you're saying and know what you're thinking, because they have to maybe, like in a movie, a bigger movie, they might do two scenes the whole day, and when you're doing an independent movie or like the series, you're doing seven or eight scenes a day. So you really have to be on your game and know what it is that you're saying and what you're talking about. You really have to do your homework.
Obviously, you've been a working actor since the 80s. You said yourself that when you were starting, a teacher was very important for you. Do you feel like you're paying that forward, working with younger actors or less experienced directors now, or how has that evolved?
Oh, definitely, without a doubt. I'll meet somebody and I'll call up my agent and if I feel like the person has something to give or just, you know, really needs a start or needs a break, I'll make phone calls for them to help them out, to get them started. I'll read scripts. My stepson, he's a writer. My godson, he wants to write. So and they're becoming quite good. So I'll, when the time is right, I'll give those scripts to my agents to give to the writing agents. If they ask me to read something, I'll give my opinion and help. So yeah, I really do try to help people who are starting out, no question.
And with younger actors, particularly on set, I mean, do they look up to you, or how does that sort of work when you work with less experienced actors?
Truthfully, yeah, they do. You know, when they're like 22 years old.
No need to be modest. No need to be modest, I said.
Well, no, I mean they do, because of movies like Goodfellas and things like that. They get a little nervous and intimidated. And sometimes that's good, because if that's what's called for in the part, I won't go out of my way to be nice and like, you know, oh, don't worry about it, everything's okay, and then I gotta choke them. I'll keep whatever the mood is supposed to be. But I'm pretty goofy, and I don't look at myself as anything special because I play make-believe, so... You know, in the trail, I keep to myself a lot. I'm quiet on set, but if I see someone's nervous, or, you know, I'll talk to them, or sometimes I'll flub a line just to, you know, so, because they'll be nervous about doing it. I really, really been fortunate to work with my idols from Robert Duvall to Gene Hackman to De Niro to Pacino to Anthony Hopkins to Vanessa Redgrave. And I would watch them work, and I would see them make mistakes. I would see them drop their lines and say, oh my God, everybody does it. They're just actors trying to get a scene together, and sometimes they remember the lines and sometimes they don't. So sometimes I'll make it easier for them, or for the, you know, someone younger, I'll make a mistake, or I'll make them laugh, or whatever, depending on what the situation is, because as far as I'm concerned, the story takes precedence.
I have one last question, a very easy question, maybe. What does acting mean to Ray Liotta?
It's just playing pretend. It's all you. I play pretend. I play make believe for a living. I take the pretending very serious, but like I said before, really, it's a children's game. You know, I used to watch my daughter with her. With her doll in the stroller, and she'd be shopping and pretending with her friend, and they would really, really get into it. And you say, that's really all it is. You're just playing pretend for a living. It's a great way to make a living, playing pretend. It's a horrible business. The business part is really rough, but I just... Acting is just playing pretend. It's make believe.
Okay. Thank you very much, Ray Liotta.
Thanks.